Now to a story about longing and loss in the West Bank, seen through the eyes of a 13-year-old Palestinian girl. In her third novel, Where the Streets Had a Name, Australian writer Runda Abdel Fattah draws on her own Palestinian heritage to tell the story of Hayat, a girl on a mission to save her dying grandmother. Hayat believes a handful of soil from Jerusalem will help bring her beloved grandmother back to life. The only obstacle is the impenetrable wall that divides the West Bank. But as Runda Abdel Fattah explains, the wall also marks the beginning of this deeply personal and political Palestinian narrative. The book shows Linda Lopresti spoke to the author about Where the Streets Had a Name.
I visited Palestine in 2000 with my family, and it was my first visit and the first occasion I had to see my father's village. And while I was there, I spoke to a lot of children, and what struck me was not only that they had a resilience and strong sense of spirit about them, but that they, at the same time, had lost hope in adults. So it, to me, felt a strange irony that they had this strength of spirit. They were just ordinary children, but then they had this, to me, quite horrifying sense that they couldn't be protected by adults. And one boy, in fact, said to me, "There are no protectors, not even our parents can protect us." So what I thought was, I want to look at the occupation from the perspective of children and what it's doing to children. And I thought there was so much rich potential for a rich narrative there, because these were children living ordinary lives, trying to get on with their childhood in the most horrific circumstances.
Indeed, and you begin the novel in Bethlehem. It's 2004, and as you say, it's a very ordinary day for your protagonist, 13-year-old Hayat, and her family who are living under curfew. And you describe in a very humorous way the boredom of that existence, especially for a spirited teen like Hayat, as she thinks about the pros and cons of living under curfew. Could you just read us that passage, Runda?
On the one hand, there's the boredom, always the boredom of being stuck at home. Home means chores and dealing with Mama and Baba's boredom. Clean your room, help me rearrange the kitchen cupboards, do your homework, go inside and study. Stop fighting with Jahan and Tariq. Would you peel the potatoes, please, your Hayat? No, did you say no? Peel them now. Then there's the important matter of meeting Sammy's latest dare to stick a potato in the exhaust of Ustaz Hani's car. Not one of the peeled potatoes. Any potato will do. Maybe this sounds obnoxious and cruel, but Ustaz Hani picks his nose and teaches us mathematics, so it's not such a bad thing to have a potato in the exhaust of his car. On the other hand, I'll have a break from school, and this is also not such a bad thing. I won't see Khadr for a while then, I whisper to myself. Who is Khadr? Mama asks. Tariq runs into the kitchen and grins up at me. Khadr is a pig. He is the poo of a pig. He is the insect that feeds on the poo of a pig. I smile at him. His moral support is endearing. Don't use such language, boy, Mama yells. But he calls her potato mash face. He is poo. Mama hits Tariq on the nape of his neck. Enough. Where did you come up with such filthy language? Yesterday you told Khal to Samar that the bathroom smells like poo because... Enough, Mama fixes him with her death stare, and he walks out of the kitchen, a puzzled look on his face. Oh God, Siti Zainab cries from the lounge room. How can Hayat learn when there is so much disruption? For such an old woman, I marvel at her hearing sometimes.
So you describe a very ordinary day in Hayat's life there. Putting potatoes in exhaust pipes is clearly a favourite pastime. And we heard there from Hayat's grandmother, Siti Zainab. Tell us about the parallels between the character and your own grandmother, who died this year in Jordan.
Well, the first time I met her was in 1988 when I went to Kuwait. I was still very young then, and to me she represented sort of a typical grandmother who lived just to feed us and give us big hugs. But then I didn't really understand why she was coming to visit Kuwait from Palestine. She was visiting alone, whereas all her family were in Kuwait. You know, it's, at that age, I didn't understand the situation. I decided when I was in first year of university that I wanted to connect with my father's family and get to know them more. So I visited Jordan, and my grandmother was living there then. My family had tricked her into coming to Jordan on a visit and then refused to send her back to Palestine. And the reason was that she was alone in her home in the village of Burqa, my father's village. But because none of her family were allowed to return to live with her, they were quite afraid because she was getting a lot older, and if she fell sick or died, there would be no one to look after her or bury her. So they tricked her into staying in Jordan. And I shared a bedroom with her, and it was during these nights of speaking with her and listening to her stories about her homeland and 1948, what happened then, and my father's childhood, that I became very close to her and started to understand a whole world and a whole part of my heritage that I had never really appreciated before. And I based a lot of the grandmother in my book on my own grandmother, particularly the humour, because that's what I guess struck me the most about it, that she sat, you know, with the key to her, this iron key to her, skeleton key, on a chain around her neck, which represented, you know, the loss of her homeland and dispossession. And yet she had this fantastic sense of humour.
And did she speak to you like the character in the book? Did she speak to you about a yearning to return home?
Definitely. It was a couple of things that really dominated her conversations with me. One was the yearning to return home. She didn't feel betrayed by her family, the fact that they had tricked her into coming to Jordan, because she felt that it was just a product of the greater dispossession and fact of exile and the consequences of that. So she spoke so much about what it was like to have her own home and her own olive groves, and she spoke so tenderly about those olive trees. But also she spoke about the consequences of dispossession in terms of my father and her other son, my uncle, being forced to leave Palestine to look for work because of what happened after 1948 and the sort of economic consequences, and how it forced the family to split up and disintegrate. And that was a terrible blow to her. And although she understood why my father left and you know, he went to Kuwait, then Egypt, and ultimately to Australia, I don't know if she ever quite forgave him or the situation that forced him into seeking a future elsewhere.
And it's that point in the book where Ziti Zainab, the grandmother, expresses her last wish to her granddaughter Hayat, that she would like to return home, or that she wishes to see her homeland, is a real turning point. Could you read us that passage in the book where she expresses that wish?
Sure. If I could have one wish, Hayat, it would be to touch the soil of my home one last time before I die. Land, ya Hayat, there is nothing so important. The deeper your roots, the taller and stronger you grow. When your roots are ripped out from under you, you risk shriveling up. All I want is to die on my land, not in my daughter's home, but in my home. I reach out my hands and touch her face. Pools of moonlight find their way through spaces in the curtains and throw shadows across her face. Her face is a chaotic map of intersecting wrinkles. Her eyes are a deep hazel and shine out from under the white of her veil, which is draped loosely around her head and shoulders out of habit. Strands of silvery fair hair fall down the sides of her face. She smiles at me and again rummages through the box, retrieving a large iron skeleton key. It hangs from the tassel of a black scarf. The key to my home. She sighs deeply and then smiles. I took it with me when we fled. I tucked it into my undergarments. It itched against my skin as we ran, but I knew I had to keep it with me, for when we returned. The tent was our new home. Eventually, when we realized we would never be allowed to return or even be compensated, we understood that the camp was permanent.
And that's when Hayat comes up with the idea of somehow getting to Jerusalem past the checkpoints and the separation wall to try and get the soil and fulfill her grandmother's wish. And she takes her best friend, Sammy, with her. We won't spoil the ending, but for you, Rhonda, what does the soil represent? Does it have some spiritual meaning?
It does. It really strikes me that the Palestinian people do have a spiritual connection with the soil. And I sometimes wonder if is it more precious because they lost it? And I always questioned my family about that. Do you yearn for it because you no longer have it? But it really does mean so much to people when it's part of their ancestral heritage, and the whole idea of the olive groves and, you know, being able to trace your lineage and your ancestral homes through the farms that you tend to, and that really struck me when I visited Palestine, that connection with the land. And I did have a family friend in Australia, Palestinian, who died last year, and on his deathbed he requested that his family try and get some soil from his village in Palestine and sprinkle it on his grave in Australia.
It's a very moving story you tell, and yet it's one which you tell in a very uplifting and humorous way. There's the scene where Hayat's sister, who's getting married, is stopped and frisked at a checkpoint, and all the shenanigans that go on with that. You've written this book with quite a healthy dose of good humour. Was that your intention from the onset?
I did, because when I met Palestinians in Palestine and when I spoke to Palestinians here when I was researching the book, I just couldn't believe how much of a sense of humour people had about the situation. And I don't think it was just for the sake of writing a book where someone could laugh. I wanted to show that that was part of the resistance of Palestinians against occupation. It defined their resilience, being able to find the humour and in the most absurd situations under occupation. And indeed, when I was interviewing one young man who had came from Bethlehem and married an Australian Palestinian, we were in the lounge room and everyone was sitting there, and I asked him about what happened when there were curfews, and I was trying really to extract the sort of the gloomy stories from him, and he told me a story about being arrested by the Israeli soldiers on the streets of Bethlehem because he didn't have his identification papers with him. And he just quite easily said, oh, and they beat me up in the van. And I was horrified, but to him it was so matter of fact. But then he proceeded to explain how all his relatives were laughing at him because the Israeli soldiers strip searched him in the street. And they were laughing because he was being strip searched in front of his Australian bride. And to me it was just such a beautiful example of the way people survive situations by seeing the humour in them.
But also, given the fact that your readership is a young readership, your target audience is young adults, was that also a factor in writing it in a very uplifting manner?
Oh, definitely. I mean, when you think of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, you don't think of laughter. And I didn't want to write a dogmatic, preachy book. I didn't want to write something that, it wouldn't capture all my readers. I wanted to show them that there is humour in this situation and to give them something to laugh about when they are introduced to a conflict that they really don't have much access to or knowledge of.
Rhonda, this is your third book about identity. I mean, Muslim identity, your first book, Does My Head Look Big In This, drew upon your own experiences about growing up as a Muslim girl in a Catholic school in Australia. Then there was 10 Things I Had About Me, again about a young girl who tries to disguise her Middle Eastern origins in high school. And now this book, Where the Streets Had a Name. Have you always felt comfortable with your own identity?
I have. Of course, there have been times when I was a teenager where it was difficult to straddle between my, Palestinian, Egyptian, Muslim heritage and feel Australian at the same time. But I think there were moments when I was a teenager where it was difficult to juggle my, hyphenated identity, and I felt confused about how I could be an Australian when I had this Egyptian and Palestinian heritage and on top of that was a Muslim. But overwhelmingly, I have felt a very positive sense of who I am, and I have felt that my identities don't clash. There is a harmony. And also, I think the reason that I felt that way is because I've never chosen to choose one part of my identity at the expense of the other. I've embraced all of them.
In fact, you do have your identity hyphens. Can you tell us what they are?
The Australian, Muslim, Palestinian, Egyptian, chocoholic. There's a lot to contend with.
Especially that last bit.
Yes.
All right. Well, your first book, as we said, Does My Head Look Big In This, was enormously successful for you, Rhonda. How difficult was it, though, to get this book published, given the controversial subject matter?
I didn't find that any difficulty in Australia. My publishers were wonderfully supportive. There was, I suppose, with the overseas, trying to get the book published overseas, in the initial stages, it was a lot more difficult because I think publishers felt that the subject matter was too controversial, that presenting the Palestinian narrative might offend the Jewish side of the story and therefore would be too biased. And to me, I had to explain that I wasn't ashamed about my bias. The fact is I'm writing a Palestinian perspective on the occupation. I'm writing from the perspective of the occupied, so the bias would be natural. And since then, I have managed to, enjoy success in securing some more overseas publishers.
That's Runda Abdel Fattah speaking to the Book Show's Linda Lopresti, and Where the Streets Had a Name is published by Pan Macmillan. This is The Book Show on ABC Radio National. I'm Ramona Koval.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.